This is the Yale University Press podcast. I'm Jessica Hollihan, and I'm delighted to introduce my guest, Charles Holland. Charles is an architect. He's the principal of Charles Holland Architects, a design and research practice based in the UK. So it's unsurprising that he's enthusiastic about architecture and buildings. And we all now are the beneficiaries of his enthusiasm, thanks to the publication of his new book, How to Enjoy Architecture, A Guide for Everyone. This book is a kind of sibling to the book How to Enjoy Art, A Guide for Everyone by Ben Street, which Yale University Press published a few years ago. And the idea is that these books are expert guides to looking at and understanding, in the case of Ben Street's book, art, and in the case of this new book by Charles Holland, architecture. Charles, I'd actually like to start by asking you about the title, which may sound a little silly because it is a beautifully straightforward title and it matches the other book. But in the book, you reference a quotation by the great architectural historian Nicholas Pevsner, who said, "A bicycle shed is a building. The Lincoln Memorial is architecture." And you take some issue with this formulation. So, you know, your book isn't titled How to Enjoy Buildings or How to Enjoy the Built Environment. And so I wanted you to talk a little bit about the object of your book's affection. How would you describe what it is you're hoping to inspire readers to enjoy?
I think what I'm trying to do, or what I wanted to do, was to try to sort of develop a vocabulary with which we could talk about buildings. And what I think tends to happen is that, you know, people have quite strong views sometimes about buildings, and people think very different things about them. But there doesn't really seem much in the way of a sort of shared language. Obviously, architects have a language of how to talk about buildings, and obviously architects also disagree about them. But outside of sort of architectural circles, it doesn't feel like there's a very shared language of how to talk about them. And obviously, they're incredibly important, and we spend all our time in them. They surround us. People get very passionate about them when they might be under threat, or whether new ones are planned that they don't like or understand. And I wanted to try to sort of talk about what I enjoy about architecture, what I find kind of incredibly rich and rewarding about it, in a way to try and open up a conversation to be less divisive and less binary and more engaged in a sort of productive way in talking about what buildings are. And I think the quote that you read out, the Pevsner quote, I mean, it seems to me like a slightly silly distinction, and I'm sure it's one that subsequent to writing, Pevsner himself probably thought was slightly ludicrous, which is to suggest that the value of buildings is really tied up in, you know, the cost of them or the sort of importance of them in kind of civic or power terms. And I wanted to also talk about the everyday to some extent. I wanted to talk about the buildings that we inhabit or visit or pass by all the time, as well as the sort of canonical major architectural milestones. I also talk about things which are just in our field of vision or stuff that we use.
So it's fair to say that, you know, this book isn't a list of the world's most beautiful buildings or Charles Holland's favorite buildings in the world. And it's not even really a book that, you know, once somebody reads it, they'll decide, oh, I thought I disliked this building, but in fact, I like it very much, but rather, you know, it's sort of a way to appreciate architecture through a greater understanding of the concepts that underpin it and the sorts of ideas and activities that go into it.
Yeah, I mean, I think enjoyment is a key word here. So how to enjoy is important as opposed to, say, how to read or how to understand, which are both reasonable things to try to maybe do or talk about, how to understand buildings. But they also, it also sounds quite worthy, and it also sounds quite sort of educational in the sense of trying to say, well, this is what you should like, or, you know, here's how to sort of understand this kind of thing, and then you'll appreciate it. So it's not about trying to educate people to like certain things, absolutely not about that. It is about trying to communicate, I think, the sort of enjoyment or the joy that I have when I look at experienced buildings, like the kind of, you know, the beauty of the sort of compositional elegance of the facade, or the kind of texture of the materials, or, you know, the kind of elegant way it might resolve certain sorts of functional things. And they're all things I think that give pleasure and therefore also give meaning to our lives. And I think that as a practicing architect, is often that's the bit that's the hardest thing to communicate to clients or other people as what architecture is and what it can do. That when it works well, and by work, I mean in the biggest sense possible, not simply that it processes people through the door quickly or it has the right number of bedrooms, but it works in the sense that on a very profound level, it's making a kind of space and a sequence of spaces that allow us to live better.
And each chapter in your book is devoted to one of the concepts around which the whole argument of the book is built, and those are style, composition, space, materials, structure, and use. And I'm guessing that these aren't organized in any kind of hierarchical way. The book doesn't read that way, or am I wrong about that?
No, there's no hierarchy to that. They're chosen, and the order in which they're placed, I suppose, is to move the book around so it doesn't become too linear or suggest a kind of hierarchy in any way. So it doesn't gravitate towards the big issue it's not a kind of linear argument. So they're mixed up so that materials isn't next to structure, so it isn't for a long time about certain kind of physical reading of architecture. And in a way, they're quite straightforward chapters, I think. I think they're ones that it would be difficult to disagree, a kind of pretty present and clearly fundamental to architecture. So I didn't really want the chapters necessarily to be incredibly complex in a disciplinary way, but it's then how they get unpacked, and hopefully then what actually is in them becomes something that's more surprising and leads to kind of thought processes and lines of inquiry which are quite unexpected.
Yeah. And so lack of hierarchy notwithstanding, I would like to start with style because of what you just said about the contents of the chapter being surprising. And it's the chapter on style isn't a list of what one might come up with if you were thinking about architectural styles through the years or something like that. What is it instead that you intended to do there?
Well, I mean, I think the idea of linearity and chronology is really important in style, because I think there's a general received wisdom within architectural culture as much as outside of it, that style is a sort of progressive thing. You know, like certain styles are historical, they get replaced because of stylistic changes and changes in society, and then we move on. And that really is a very art historical, neat way of thinking about style. And there are lots of prejudices within that, which is that there are appropriate styles for the day. And people say, well, it's not appropriate to design architecture in that way anymore. We've moved on from that. So there's all sorts of things that are kind of packaged up in that idea that style is a sort of progressive sequence. But actually, it isn't. Styles come in and out. People go back and forth in time, retrieving different things from architecture. The most obvious one is the Renaissance, which is a kind of retrieval of essentially Roman architecture. The 15th, 16th centuries. So it's a shuttling back in time and then taking something forward, which then becomes something completely different. And as I tried to talk about in the style, you also just get neo-style. So you get the return of styles in a very explicit way. So the most obvious one, and in many ways a very pejorative one, is neo-Georgian. So neo-Georgian is always seen as a kind of inferior version of something that was authentic once and is now merely pastiche. And I wanted to contest that a bit, which is not to say wave a flag for Neo-Georgianism in particular, but to contest the idea that styles don't come back, and that more than that, when they do come back, they're lesser than when they were before. So I wanted to problematize that, to use a bit of an academic term, and show that style is something that's quite volatile. And also because I think style is incredibly important to architects, but is actually weirdly not talked about by them very much. They tend to react quite negatively when put into a stylistic box. and they tend to talk about their work, if one could make very big generalizations, they tend to talk about their work and justify their work according to lots of things, but not style. That feels a bit arbitrary. It feels a bit personal. It feels like hard to hard to justify, especially when you're spending a lot of someone else's money, that you wanted to make it a style. So I think it's an uncomfortable subject for architects, which is why I also wanted to talk about it, because I think it's one that's really important and it guides our judgment a lot of the time. And I find it's one of the strong ways that I relate to buildings. I can start to see and understand and read certain aesthetic, stylistic tropes that the architect is working with. And for me, that's a quite big part of the meaning of a building, at least visually.
Do you think that that sort of kind of anxiety of influence is a particular issue for contemporary architects? I mean, one of the specific architects that comes up in that chapter is someone who you hold up as a rare example of an architect who had a style that really was entirely her own, and that's Zaha Hadid. So do you think that this is something that is a particular pull on contemporary architects or not so much?
No, I think that probably in history there have been periods where architects have been more explicitly and more comfortably talking about style, you know, kind of choosing styles to work in. I don't think it's something that is actually very current in architectural debates. I think it's probably more current in general, more popular discussions about architecture, where someone might say, well, why is it that style? Or, I don't like that style. They might be referring to like brutalism, or they might be referring to Palladianism or whatever. But I think that is a fairly regular sort of point at which people engage with architecture. I don't think it happens that much within architectural culture. The Zaha Hadid example is interesting to me because it's really about personal style, and that her mystique and her career and her personal mythology, which is very powerful, was built on a very explicitly personal style. That's actually quite difficult to do in architecture, where personality is diffused through like a very complex process involving an awful lot of people. And so style in the sense of, say, Palladianism is very different, I think, and I talk about that, but it's very different to say style in the sense of Zaha Hadid, which is because she made her name doing paintings, and only one person can do a painting, and one person can do a painting that is, you know, very obviously a sort of extension of themselves. It's a physical act which sort of extends their personality into a kind of pictorial space. Buildings don't work like that. So it's very interesting, the idea that she set up a kind of career based on an incredibly strong personal style, which I think is ultimately very tested by the process of trying to do collaborative projects, which are what architectural projects are. But it allowed another way of talking about style, I guess, which was to import something a little bit perhaps from more fine art, the fine art world, where an individual's style or sort of physical expression is more understandable.
Right. I'd like to pull out just one idea from the chapter on composition, and that is this kind of balance or maybe even dichotomy between the goal of perfection and the embrace of imperfection. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, well, I think, I mean, that's really fascinating, I think, to me, because, of course, buildings have to navigate incredibly different demands. And, you know, architects work both in, you know, plan and section and three dimensions, and then with certain kind of realities. And I think part of the challenge and part of the joy of doing it is trying to resolve those things into something that has a kind of aesthetic compositional quality that is, you know, it is enjoyable in its own right, both to experience and to kind of know it's sort of there. So I think, you know, that's always present, that, you know, you're basically trying to design something and then go, oh, I actually realise there need to be three urinals. That's ruined my entire symmetry in my composition. So that's kind of present, and that's a sort of, you know, and the sites are irregular and they're funny shapes, and, you know, there are things underneath the ground that mean you can't put foundations down, all these sort of difficult things when you're trying to basically make a sort of balanced composition. The thing about perfection is interesting as well, because I think, you know, different kinds of architecture have different ideas of resolving those. And, you know, obviously certain kind of classical architecture would be very fixated on kind of ideas of symmetry, and in particular, you know, bilateral symmetry, effectively, by which the building's the same on both sides around a kind of central kind of core. And that is a perfection of some kinds, but also leads to very strange compromises, because you might end up with funny shaped rooms just because you want to balance the composition. So perfection is relative. It might be perfect in the plan, but it might be slightly impractical in physical experience. So it's quite rich, but I tried to talk about it in different ways. So sometimes it's there in how you plan buildings, sometimes it's there in the elevation. And of course it's there in sectional qualities, but some of these things are more tangible than others. And I think in that chapter I talk about elevations, which are perhaps the closest thing way that architecture gets to a picture, because we look at elevations in a way that we don't look at plans or sections. We experience those, and we experience elevations, of course, but they have a relationship between, certainly in, older, more classical buildings, which are very much built around a series of composed facades, that, you're looking at them almost like you're looking at a picture. And an example I give is, I really make a comparison. There's an Alberti building when we talk about development of the classical facade, where he's taking a kind of language of classicism, which is essentially taken from Roman architecture, and he's turning it into something which allows you to position windows and compose columns and voids and solids into the facade of a building. And he does this incredible thing for the first time, almost, about how to do this. And then I contrast that with the work of the American firm Venturi Scott Brown, who are doing much more everyday buildings. And in their buildings, they speak about a relationship between a kind of idealized version of what the building would be and a sort of reality. And they make that tension between the two part of the enjoyment of the architecture. So the example in the book is Fire Station Number 4 in Indiana, which has a much wider facade than they might think is right in aesthetic proportional terms. So they make parts of the facade in a different material in order to sort of almost show you the perfect example of it. And then you can kind of read the tension with the one that's not quite right. It's almost like having a pair of trousers and then they're too long, and then changing material at the point at which they would be the right length.
Well, and so that leads me to a question about how we experience buildings. And I think as I was reading the book, the concept that was sort of hardest for me to digest was that of space. I think because, as a non-architect, the way I experience buildings is through this kind of idea of space. I don't walk into a room and say, oh, the walls are just the right size. I walk into a room and say, oh, this is a nice size for, my bedroom or whatever it is I might be considering the room for. Or, this theater was built just with the exact right proportions to house the performances that it was meant to do. But it's not, you write in the book that that the outcome of composition is an object and the space in it. And I guess the idea that those are two different things was kind of surprising to me. So, how would you help people like me understand space as an architectural idea?
Yeah, I really wanted to tackle the issue of space, because I think it's partly because it is a really difficult concept. It's an absence. It's the thing that's not there. So it's no wonder that's quite tricky to talk about. But architects talk about it a lot, and I think for good reason, although it's possible to be a little suspicious of that at times and go, what are they actually talking about? But I thought it was really important to talk about, because I think what I was trying to get at in this chapter is there are tangible differences between different kinds of space. And those differences are not necessarily the same thing as where the walls are, or what's on the walls, or what furniture's in the room, or what the ceiling's like, but actually the bit that you're in. And in a funny sort of way, it's the most important bit, because it is the bit that we're in. Everything else is stationary, and space is a really sort of interesting kind of dynamic. The example I give in the book is the way to start, I think, is I go, well, what if you could see space? What if the bit that's not there, the absence, became present and was a physical thing? And so I use the example of the British artist Rachel Whiteread, who casts space effectively, and she, her work moves from a period from making casts of quite small spaces like the underside of a chair to eventually casting the inside of a London Victorian house. And the house is gone, and what you're left with is basically the space inside, which is rendered as a solid concrete thing. It's like you've poured concrete into a house and then take the house away. And so I start with that and go, well, here's space. You can actually see it now, and you can see that there is something. And then I say, well, okay, that's recording a kind of space that already exists. But when architects design, they're doing something else. They're actually designing space. So then I start to talk about how you might design space in different ways and what the I suppose the sort of compositional things you're doing that might result in different kinds of spatiality. I suppose examples of what that might mean in a common parlance might be, you know, difference in a kind of open plan space, which is sort of quite flowing and fluid, and then very cellular space, contained space, series of discrete rooms. And those things are different experientially, but they're also different culturally, because, you know, when we have a flowing space and a space that's not differentiated or cut up, we have very different social relations as a consequence. An example of this might be in the home, but might say be in the office, where if you have, there's the managing director's office and here's my office, and they're different because they're different spaces and they're not connected to each other. But if they're one space, I'm not suggesting that means the world's suddenly fair, but clearly there's a different kind of, one could talk about it as territory almost, that there are different territories or territories that interconnect. So these things have physical repercussions, but also cultural and social and political ones. I mean, something like the Berlin Wall would be an incredibly powerful example of two different kinds of political space, historically speaking, one on one side and one on the other. And are they different spaces? Or are they just different governing kind of agencies over the same space? And that, I guess that's what I wanted to explore.
Yeah, it is a thought-provoking chapter that you sort of want to stop after and think about how, you know, apart from architecture, it really has a lot to do with how we move around the world every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that chapter is the one that zooms out the biggest. And I talk about planning of towns and the design of landscapes when you get big sort of human interventions in the landscape, and things like difference in gridded space and other forms of, you know, composition, which are really, I suppose, how one might start to navigate that if you're a designer, how one starts to sort of divide up what is something that's kind of not exactly there but is there. So yeah, it has huge repercussions. And, you know, things like, you know, somebody owns this piece of land and someone owns the other piece of land, and I think it's important that I wanted to talk about it not just in a sort of phenomenological sense, that, like, you know, a room with a window high up on the south side of it would bring in sunlight in a particular way, and we might talk about the spatial qualities of that. But I wanted to talk about it, yeah, more in a wider sense too, that it's in that sort of sense of territory, or the way we divide space up, the way we allocate different functions to different places. So that's a bathroom and that's a bedroom, and they're different spaces, and we get very used to that. And I think sort of taking some time to unpack that reveals lots of fascinating things about how we divide space up for each of us and between us.
One of the ways that you've written the book that makes it very easy to digest, actually, is that, you know, you sort of start each chapter with a theoretical discussion of the concept and then offer examples. Most of the time you offer examples of the concept you're talking about. But in the chapter on structure, interestingly, you offer a kind of counterexample, because in the chapter on structure, you talk about structure, you know, the goal being that it is largely invisible, and then talk about the Japanese architect Kazuo Shinohara as a kind of counterexample to that. Will you tell that story?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of it not being visible, I suppose, is that it's obviously physical stuff, but it's also a sort of principle. You know, structure in the building is also like how it stands up in a sort of mathematical way and an organizational way, as well as the fact that there are physical bits of stuff, timber and steel and brick, that are holding it up. But a lot of the time, I suppose that, a bit like space in a way, structure isn't visible. When you're in a building, say you're in one which is constructed from brick, you don't really look at it and go, that's structure, because the structure is also a wall, and the wall has also got a door in it, and the wall might also have a picture on it. So there's you're looking at something which is doing a lot of different things. It's providing a background, it's providing an enclosure, it's holding something up. So sort of structure in that way sort of disappears a little bit. Shinohara's work's really interesting because, and I think partly because he was a mathematician before he became an architect, is that the structure becomes incredibly present in his buildings, and often in a really obstructive way, which I think is, it's quite interesting, quite counterintuitive. Look at one of his apartments and, there's a huge piece of concrete structure in the middle of it, deliberately placed as a provocation and as something that is clearly slightly clumsy and interrupts what might be a more easy space to be in. And, clearly his work is very refined and very sort of aesthetic. But what he does is sort of remind you in a way of what is actually present in the construction of the building. And I thought that was a really interesting example to show in relation to much more normative ideas of structure. Like you've got a frame and you hang some windows off it, or you've got a wall and you've got a roof on top. And then the objectives are almost to not see it and not to understand it or be aware of it. So here's a sort of useful example in that. And as perverse as this stuff is, as a sort of poetry and being able to kind of see quite complex forces and calculations made palpable.
Well, I'd like to finish up by asking a question that I hope you don't think is unfair, but I think it's interesting to ask, have the opportunity to ask authors about what they thought about their audiences when they were writing the book. And in fact, your book's subtitle proposes that it is for everyone, and I think that it holds up to that. But I wondered what you thought as you were writing it about, the differences between how someone, just a general reader might be reading it versus a student of architecture versus a practicing architect, and how you tried to make it actually a guide for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, first, I'm glad if that subtitle does resonate with how it's written, because that's definitely the intention. I think I wanted each of those people to get something from it. I think a really strong motivation in writing the book for me was a slight frustration with how architecture is talked about. And I wanted, for me, it's really incredibly important. It's everywhere, and it really affects our lives in ways that are both humdrum and normal and super profound, depending on what we're doing. It might be the place we choose for a birthday party, or it might be a kind of place we go on holiday. It might be somewhere we work every day. Lots of different examples where it's incredibly important, the space that we're in. And sometimes we choose it and sometimes we don't. And therefore, it seems really important to me that there's a way that more of us can talk about it in a meaningful way, and we can move beyond I don't like, I do like, into why we think those things, and also thinking like, it's okay if I don't like it, actually. I can't like everything, and I don't like every piece of music, and I don't like every kind of food, so it's okay there's a building on the corner of my street that I don't like because other people do. And that's also important, I think. I'm basically incredibly pro pluralism. I'm pro as much sort of choice and aesthetic difference as can be. I'm not interested in promoting a style or a particular view. My own work, I might be working through those sorts of things myself, but this book isn't really about that. This book is about how we might approach all sorts of different kind of buildings and perhaps break down a few prejudices along the way. So I wanted it to be something where it was useful in that way, and that you could pick it up and not be baffled by terminology or jargon. So I tried very hard to avoid that. As you say, I tried to sort of take these topics and break them down a bit, but then very much to root the book in looking and experience at buildings in the everyday, as if you know, you were doing it when, as the reader was doing it themselves. So this isn't about always choosing lofty examples. And even when it is choosing, inevitably, a building, which of course is in another time and space to you, the reader, but you might be able to sort of apply some of that thinking to the place where you are. At the same time, I think it was important. I didn't want to dumb it down. I didn't want to write a straightforward guide. And therefore, it's not a history. It's not another attempt to tell the history of architecture or the story of the development of architecture. It is what it is, which is quite a sort of personal account of what I find really fascinating, enjoyable, wonderful about buildings. And hopefully in a way that if you work in the industry or you design buildings or you're very knowledgeable about them, the stuff in there that asks important questions. And if you're less so, it's approachable and kind of open enough to start getting a really good purchase on how one might think about these things in a slightly different way. So, yeah, I hope it appeals across those different kind of audiences. And that's obviously quite a challenging thing. That's like a big task. But I wrote it in a way where I wanted to, by taking out, I think, you know, lots of the sort of recognized language and then being able to sort of talk about it slightly afresh. That was my hope.
Well, it's a lovely, lovely, interesting book. Thank you. Thank you for writing it. And thank you for talking to me about it today.
Thank you very much.
The book is How to Enjoy Architecture, A Guide for Everyone by Charles Holland. It's available now at a bookstore near you. Thank you for listening. Please visit us online at yalebooks.com for more episodes of the podcast, as well as information about all of our books.